not China that pays tariffs. It's the American importers, the American companies that pay what in effect is a tax increase and oftentimes passes it on to U.S. consumers.
Fair enough. In fact, both sides will pay. Both sides will pay in these things. And of course, it depends.
If it's a tariff on goods coming into the country, the Chinese aren't paying.
No, but the Chinese will suffer GDP losses and so forth.
I understand that, but the president says China doesn't. China it pays the tariffs. They may suffer consequences, but it's U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers who pay. Correct?
Yes, to some extent.
Larry Kudlow, President Trump's top economic advisor, with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, correcting Trump's false assertion that the Chinese will pay the tariffs he slapped on Chinese goods coming into this country. Well, today, China retaliated and announced $60 billion worth of tariffs on American goods, including a lot of agricultural products like soybeans. Let's talk about that now with Brett Davis, a fourth-generation soybean farmer in Delaware, Ohio. Hi.
Hi there.
And also here to talk about the effects of Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods, we're joined by Michael Fishman, the president of Pure Cycle Bicycles in Burbank, California, which imports bikes and bike parts from China. Hi there, Michael.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, let's begin with you, Michael. What was your reaction to the announcement on Friday that Trump was slapping these tariffs on Chinese imports? I understand you already had a shipment of bicycle parts on the way.
So this has been going around for about the past year, but, you know, we were under the impression that these next 15% were going to be delayed. So what now that we have $200,000 of bike parts on the water and bicycles, you know, this is a huge cash flow hit from us from suspecting to pay about $30,000 in duties to now about $50,000. So a $20,000 increase that is just coming about in 3 days. So that's not very much time to prepare.
So this happens immediately. So it affects goods that are already in transit.
Yeah. So if you had goods on the water as of Friday, you'll have to pay the extra 25%, and then you can submit like an appeal to get that money back. But if you didn't have the goods on the water as of Friday, your bikes went on the water on Monday, then you're going to be subject to the extra 25%. So I have some containers that made the deadline and some that didn't.
And then going forward, of course, you wouldn't get any help.
That's exactly right. Or if, you know, next week there's going to be a tweet that says, a deal was made. Who knows, you know, if maybe I'll be able to appeal and get that money back.
And then do you pass on the cost to people who buy your bikes?
Yeah, it's challenging because we've already done a price raise at the beginning of this year. And we have so many different distributors that we sell through. To do a price raise is not such an easy thing, especially when you have large retailers like Amazon and REI. Those guys don't move very quickly. You know, this is something that's really going to stick long term, and it's who knows if that's true or not. We're going to have to do another price raise. You know, it's going to be the U.S. customers who are going to be paying for this at the end of the day. But in the short term, it's going to be us, because I can't just run a business where my price is going up and down and up and down. There's got to be some consistency to it.
Right. So it's the uncertainty that's also a problem, not just the increase in the tariffs.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not having the ability to plan, especially as a small business where $20,000 that all of a sudden I need to come up with now within less than a week of notice, you know, that's extremely difficult for me. I don't just have that laying around.
Brett Davis, soybean farmer, let's talk to you a little bit about the other side of it. So now China today announces retaliatory tariffs, which means it'll cost more for Chinese people to buy your goods over in China. So you're having sort of the opposite situation as Michael, or at least the same situation, but in the other country. How's it going to affect you?
Well, we've already lost a great deal of our exports to China. Before this started, we as American soybean growers exported one-third of the soybeans that we grow to China. Not just export, but to China. And since we've had the tariffs put on, those exports have gone to about zero. So our trouble is that we've got all these soybeans sitting here that we've raised and are in the middle of trying to sell them to other countries, which are buying our soybeans. but they're buying them a container at a time, where when the Chinese bought a load of soybeans, they bought a Panamax at a time. So farmers have lost, like a year ago today, I could sell beans for $10.30 a bushel. Today, or actually at my local elevator, it would be about $7.20 a bushel.
So huge hit. Beans. So that's like a third.
So a third of our income, and that is our profit. It's not just what affects us today, but we've spent 40 years trying to grow this market. And the trouble is they can buy soybeans from South America, which produces a large amount of soybeans also, and which puts we've got a great amount of beans sitting in America that we can't sell to those Chinese people.
Huge effect. So you're saying that you're exporting zero soybeans to China?
Not zero, but it's the Chinese have bought some, has been announced when they've made concessions back and forth. They've announced that they are going to buy, but now since the tariffs are higher, there's no reason for them to buy those soybeans. So, and the trouble is with that is not just this year, but now I cannot show a profit for the next 4 to 5 years when I don't have that market available to us. So it doesn't just affect us today with the tariffs. It affects not just the farmers, but it affects all rural America. You know, we spend money in grocery stores and the repair stores and the hardware stores, and we support our kids and grandkids ball teams and things like that. And so you talk about putting a hit on the rural economy, this affects all of middle America.
Have you already seen that play out in the last year?
Well, the president had a market payment to us because he knew that the tariffs would hurt us very much. But that market payment was like $1.65, I believe it was here, per bushel. But we've lost about $3 per a bushel in what we can sell those beans for. And the reason we can't get that price is because we have so many beans sitting here in our commercial elevators and on farmers' farms.
Right. So you have too much supply and you have no one to
Correct.
Buy it.
Yes.
And so, and then you have South America, as you say, filling the vacuum for China.
Yes.
So how is this affecting your ability in the long term? You said that this is going to affect your profits for years. Don't you usually every year farmers, by and large, get loans and then pay them back at the end
sure.
of the season?
Sure.
How do you get a bank loan if you can't show a profit?
My banker's my best friend right now because he knows everything that goes on my farm. And the only thing that is helping us as farmers right now is the interest is still fairly low. But the trouble is, if I don't have the money to pay that back, and then it'll be, you know, why would the bank loan me money the next year if I cannot pay back what I did this year? And that's where it comes to is us as farmers are using everything that we've worked for in the past 30 to 40 to 50 years to keep us current on our loans so that we can keep on farming. So we are living off of what we've made in the past 10 to 15 years, but it's not going to last too much longer.
Did you vote for Trump?
Most of middle America voted for Mr. Trump. I guess I chose what I thought was the best candidate out there. And to me, myself, I believe that Mr. Trump was the best candidate at the time.
Would you vote for him again in 2020?
I can't answer that today. It depends on what happens from here on. And that's one thing that we as the soy growers, American Soybean Association, would really urge the administration. And we have talked to our representatives around Mr. Trump that the tariff helps no one. You know, they have to pay for higher food prices in their country. we have to pay for higher prices of goods in this country. And as a farmer sitting here, the only one who's come ahead in this is the South American agriculture. Maybe they can produce enough that we can't sell our product.
And Michael, back to you. Long term, we just heard what Brett was talking about in terms of many years out. He's afraid for his business, afraid he won't be able to get loans eventually. Where do you see your business a few years out?
Yeah, so, you know, up to this point, over 90% of all people who are importing bikes into the U.S. are importing from China. So all of these manufacturers in China, when they started hearing this news of these tariffs last year, quickly started opening up other manufacturing plants in Asia. So whether that's Cambodia or Vietnam, people going to Taiwan or people going to even India, there's been a lot of options that have been created. In the long term, I'm not concerned. Like, you know, we cannot afford to be raising our prices on our bikes, nor can anyone in this industry. It's not like the bike industry is just a booming industry. I mean, people are willing to pay more, they're not. So in the long term, everyone's going to be making their bikes outside of China if these tariffs continue. But it's the short term that really hurts us the most. And, you know, our bikes have like, or everyone's bikes have like anywhere from a 3-month to like 8-month lead time of when you place the order to when they're actually going to be shipping. So it's just the short term of bikes that I already had on order that just really hurts the most.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today and explaining your situation. Michael Fishman, co-founder and president of Pure Cycle Bicycles here in Burbank, California. Brett Davis, fourth generation soybean farmer in Delaware, Ohio. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Guess what? If you go online at kcrw.com/join, you will be automatically entered to win 4 passes to each of KCRW's 6 World Festival Series at the iconic Hollywood Bowl. Sweepstakes ends Wednesday at midnight. Those 4 passes include a $100 dining gift certificate for each show and some picnic swag. These concerts take place throughout the summer. Chromeo, Toro y Moi, Reggae Night, Natalia Lafourcade with Gustavo Dudamel. I will be hosting that concert. Lord Huron, Shaky Graves, Yola, Cafe Tacuba, just goes on and on. You could be the winner of 4 tickets, so you could bring some friends to each of those concerts. But you have to go online, kcrw.com/join. We are in our UnDrive fundraiser. This is the last week, so now's the time to do it. So do it, and thank you so much. Coming up on the show, Jessica Levinson, the legal eagle on why Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh sided with the liberal justices in a case against Apple, and why police in San Francisco may have broken the law when they raided a journalist's home. All that coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, hold on to your Apple gift cards. The Supreme Court today said an antitrust suit over how the tech giant runs its app store can move forward. So it's a decision the Trump administration opposed, but Trump's latest nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, supported it along with the 4 liberal justices. This ruling is a big blow for Apple. Jessica Levinson is here to tell us about the case, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Hi.
Hi.
Well, who's suing Apple and why?
Well, consumers are suing Apple, and they're doing that because they're saying basically that when they buy apps through their iPhones, that they're being overcharged, and they're being overcharged in a way that actually violates federal monopoly laws. And none of that, whether or not they're being overcharged in a way that violates federal monopoly laws, was decided today. What was decided today is, can those consumers be the one to sue? Or does it have to be the app developers themselves? And what Apple had argued is it has to be the app developers. And it has to be the app developers because there's this old 1977 Supreme Court case law that basically says you have to be a direct purchaser in order to be the person who sues. And what the court today with Justice Kavanaugh said is not so fast. And actually, the consumers can be seen as direct purchasers here. And they get to be the ones to sue. So today is all about who gets to go forward against Apple.
Why wouldn't consumers be the direct purchasers since consumers are the ones who pay for the apps?
Well, that's a great question. So what Apple said is that the developers paid Apple a 30% commission and then passed that markup onto consumers. So consumers were basically one more step downstream in commerce. That the argument, if it really was one between Apple and they're essentially price gouging or setting the prices too high, that was just between Apple and the developers, that the developers did not have to pass, for instance, those higher prices onto consumers. And so they said, if anybody wants to sue Apple, it's the web developers. They're the ones who have the beef with us. Now, Apple, I think, very rightly realized that they did not want to open the floodgates of litigation to consumers for this suit and, frankly, for any other type of federal antitrust suit.
Right. So this is a big problem for Apple because a lot of people are saying, hey, it's just too big, along with all the other tech giants. So do you think that this could open the door to other lawsuits against, let's say, Amazon or Facebook?
Absolutely. This is one of the ones that's been on people's list all Supreme Court term. And that's because, obviously, this decision about who can sue, it's not just about consumers being able to sue Apple in this specific instance dealing with apps and whether or not consumers are being overcharged for apps, but it has to do with who can sue these big companies in order to try and vindicate federal monopoly law rights. And so in that way, it really is a big decision.
So is it surprising to you, Jessica, that Justice Brett Kavanaugh, pretty conservative, sided with the liberals in this case?
I actually think it's not surprising for two reasons. The first reason is if you listen to the oral arguments in this case, you could hear the justices questioning, and this is about where they were going. It looked like there was going to be a 5-4 break with Justice Kavanaugh in the majority. The second reason is Justice Kavanaugh has actually been more pragmatic and in some ways more moderate than people would have anticipated. So there's two new Trump appointees this term. Obviously, there's Justice Neil Gorsuch and Justice Brett Kavanaugh. We've seen on a number of different issues, Justice Kavanaugh has asked questions and written opinions that indicates he cares more about the practical application of the law. And we see Justice Kavanaugh, I think, frankly, a little bit more in the mold of the person he replaced, the swing vote, Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Hmm. Okay, let's move on to this other story. It's out of San Francisco, and it involves the public defender there, the former public defender, Jeff Adachi. He died suddenly in February, and initially the details of how he died were incomplete. Some have come out. They're pretty embarrassing, involving drug use. A journalist named Brian Carmody obtained a confidential police report, and then police arrived with a sledgehammer to his apartment, guns drawn, and carted away all of his reporting equipment, his cameras, his notebooks, his phones, his computers, etc. So even if they have or if they had a search warrant, is that legal because Brian Carmody is a journalist?
Well, that's the big question. And you have to think that there's a lot of crime TV writers and producers right now who are thinking, God, I wish I would have thought of that story, or that story just strains common sense. So what Carmody is arguing here is a couple of different things. One, he's saying there's a California shield law, and that's a state law that specifically protects journalists from being held in contempt for refusing to identify sources. And it explicitly says, police, you don't get to seize items that are covered by this law. And he's saying, police, that's exactly what you did. You're clearly trying to find out who my source was, who leaked this police information to me. and you can't do it. He's also arguing, and there's no suit yet, but this is what he's arguing essentially in the press, is I'm protected under the First Amendment. I'm a member of the press. And what the police department obviously is saying is, well, we have the right to investigate leaks. This leak could amount to obstruction of justice. This leak could amount to illegal distribution of police material. And so we're seeing these two really important interests being pitted against each other in this case.
They're also saying that, oh, he may have had stolen or fenced goods that they were investigating.
Right. So part of this will turn on something that we don't know, which is there were two different affidavits that were signed by judges. And in both cases, the judges said, yes, there's probable cause to go into his home and to go into his office. And these affidavits were apparently prepared by the police department, not the DA's office. Now, if the probable cause was based on you have engaged in illegal behavior and you have stolen goods, then those affidavits are likely fine and not problematic. If the affidavits actually are based on we need to go and use a sledgehammer to break down this guy's house because we need the information about the confidential source, then we have both state and federal law issues here.
All right, Jessica Levinson, our legal eagle on Mondays here on Press Play, law professor at Loyola Law School on all the other days. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
All right, the legal eagle. She's got a huge fan base out there. If you are part of it and you haven't joined KCRW or renewed your membership, well, now is the time. Show your support for the legal eagle and she shall soar evermore. 800-600-KCRW, kcrw.com/join. We are in our final week of our UnDrive pledge drive. It ends exactly a week from today. So now's the time to get in on it. And we have tons of sweepstakes you can be a part of, lots of great opportunities, lots of great swag on our website. You can get a brand new t-shirt or sweatshirt or, yes, even the tote bag. But you have to be online, kcrw.com/join, to do it. So do that now. We really, really thank you. We can't survive without you. This is our UnDrive pledge drive, our big spring fundraiser, and we're just coming to you between the breaks. We're not interrupting any programming, so you get the full uncut version of the legal eagle. That is something to cheer for. 800-600-5279, kcrw.com. Coming up, what it was like to run for office for the first time and have it documented on camera.
We're always told that you never let them see you cry as a woman. It's a sign of weakness. I was like, you absolutely cannot include this.
The new documentary, Knock Down the House, about four women who ran for Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, talk about being in the right place at the right time. The filmmakers who made the new Netflix doc, Knock Down the House, began shooting four first-time female congressional candidates about a year ago. One of them was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I hope to have the honor of having the support of the Yemeni community, but I also acknowledge that I have to earn it and deserve it every single day.
Assalamu alaikum, Eid Mubarak, Amar Nam Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm trying out here. I'm running for Congress out here.
Well, the film follows her from the beginning as she's just learning how to knock on doors to her improbable win over a veteran Democratic congressman. The filmmakers follow three other women, too, but even though they share Ocasio-Cortez's working-class background and they ran on a similar progressive platform, they did not win. And we're going to speak with one of them now. Her name is Amy Villela, and she ran in a district just north of Las Vegas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about why you ran in the first place. You obviously were not in politics before, and how did you look around you and say, you know what, I need to do this?
You know, at the time that the 2018, when we were talking about people running, at that point, I was just your typical working family. I was a CFO. I had no intention at all to ever run for Congress. Mm-hmm. But I unfortunately went through a tragedy that 30,000 Americans a year are facing. And that's the loss of a loved one due to a lack of health insurance. I lost my daughter at the age of 22. because she could not provide proof of insurance. She died from a needless death. She died of a pulmonary embolism. And it was a very painful and tragic end for my daughter. It took me about a year to have the strength to even get involved with anything outside of just existing. Mm-hmm. And when I did come out, I started looking around and I started researching, understanding how vast this problem was, that my daughter was not just a tragedy, that there were numerous people every year dying from a lack of health care. So I started doing activism. And when I went to my local representative, Reuben Kiewen, on Mother's Day weekend and told him the story of my daughter, I sat there in the audience and I was crying because it was very, very hard. It was only the second Mother's Day after her passing. And I was explaining to him how they had to even pull me away from her coffin because knowing that that's the last time you're going to see your child, I can't even explain how that feels. And he looked at me and said, you know, I was asking him to support Medicare for All. And he looked at me and said, you know, I'm very busy right now with North Korea. I'm very busy. We've named another number of other things that he's working on. And he said, you know, I heard your story today. You know, I didn't even have to be here. I could have been enjoying my weekend. And in my mind at that moment, it was like, I am going to primary you. You are not a public celebrity. You are a public servant. Mm-hmm. And that was really the beginning of my journey into politics.
Wow. And so I guess most people would think, well, I'm just angry. Maybe I'll write a letter. I'll vote against him or I'll work for another candidate. But they don't think I'm going to run against my congressman.
For me, it was he was a member of the Progressive Caucus. He was someone who was constantly saying how he believed healthcare was a human right. And so it really struck me at that moment. You know, we had been advocating and pushing for this. I had been throwing rallies. I had, you know, been working within the community. Within the first time I threw a rally ever in my life, actually, I invited Congresswoman Dina Titus to attend. And she actually, within the week, had co-sponsored Medicare for All. So, you know, there was some additional phone calls made before I actually announced. There was some additional pressure. I did go to his office and speak to his staff. The community had poured out. There was numerous phone calls made. When it became apparent he was not going to budge on this, I knew that I could not remain silent. I could not live my comfortable life and be complicit. I just was not going to sit back and know that other families we're going to endure the same kind of heart-wrenching pain that my family had to endure. And if not me, then who?
Yeah. Well, it eventually wasn't you. And so take us to election night. I mean, we see you in the movie, very upset. You're crying at one point, swearing at another point. Totally understandable reaction.
Keenan, you were the most awesome campaign manager I could ask for. We did this without knowing
That's true.
And you stuck through everything, and we're there, and I love you.
We have new results.
That's how I feel.
You know, I get a lot of questions about that, and that was really actually a hard scene in the movie for me to be okay with. When Rachel shared with us a preliminary of the movie, I was like, you absolutely cannot include this. You know, no way. I mean, here I am, a woman who has struggled through poverty, who was a single mom. You know, I struggled my way out of that. I, you know, worked my way through the business ladder, you know, and we're always told that you never let them see you cry as a woman. It's a sign of weakness. Well, anyone that's watching the movie that knows me in life knows that I am not weak. I'm anything but. And I had to really think about, you know, letting that in the movie. And, you know, Rachel was like, you know, just sleep on it. Think about it, Amy. And so I really thought about that night. And I thought about all of the information that women given as they're growing up, as they're entering into the work field, and you know, all the false narratives were given about what a woman's supposed to be. And I thought, you know, it's about time that we show that it's okay. It's okay to have a loss. It's okay to care enough to actually show emotion, and you can be strong and cry at the same time. And the second thing that came to mind was, you know, it's about time that we have politicians that care that much. Because as I was losing, what you don't really get out of the film is the reason why I was crying so much. I had been holding Shalynn's urn all day. And
this is your daughter.
I felt,
and
the, yes.
And her ashes you were holding?
Yes, I was holding her ashes all day. And I felt the way the community, I remember all the people that I met, the homeless people that didn't have any health care, the people that didn't make enough money to provide sufficiently for their families, the people that were truly suffering because we weren't pushing for bold legislation to really solve the problems of people in our own community. And the first thing that came out of my mouth when the results were final, I yelled out, now more people are going to die. And I couldn't save them like I couldn't save Shalynn. And that's when I broke into tears. I felt the weight of the community and my love for the community and the people here in this country was overwhelming to me, you know, feeling that you couldn't pull it off, that you couldn't actually help make change was weighing on my soul. And I think AOC actually talks about that at one point where she's scared about the cynicism.
Of the cynicism that could result from people really believing in something and then it not working out.
How do you feel that she's done so far? And I guess, are you surprised that she's become such a big star?
No, I'm not surprised, to be honest with you, because being out in the community and all of us are very close, all of the candidates across the country, and we saw on the ground the amount of fervor and excitement over having policies like this actually, you know, being proposed to fight for. People need something to vote for. And so, you know, we knew that if we could just get a couple of us in there, that that would really change the conversation. You know, we didn't have the money to push out the message as far as we needed to in order to win our races. And we did win a lot of, I mean, lose a lot of races across the country. But what we didn't lose was the conversation. And we really helped spread that conversation where people are now asking, if you look at this presidential run right now on the Democratic side, you see all of them are having to answer the questions, where are you getting your money? Are you going to support Medicare for all? Are you going to support tuition-free colleges and universities? You know, these are the questions that the American people are asking because they now have some hope that we're going to be fighters. We're not just going to fight for the status quo. We're going to protect what we have, but simultaneously fight for improvement because people are suffering and in some cases dying.
And so when you say we, and you're talking about you had a network of first-time candidates, you were supported by a PAC, right, called Justice Democrats?
Yes.
And there were like 30 candidates that this and other PACs supported?
Yes, it was Justice Democrats, Brand New Congress, and Our Revolution were the main supporters of my campaign, and right. The nurses.
Right, and the nurses, yeah. And so was that part of it too? Like then they did they recruit you or, I mean, you obviously made a decision to run on your own, but were you part of their organization as you were deciding to run?
Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress work on the level that people in the community have to actually put you up to be considered to run. So those are led by the community. They're community driven. Our Revolution, on the other hand, I had been working closely with Our Revolution as well as the nurses on the Medicare for All outreach and activism.
Do they support you financially, organizationally? Like, what's the advantage of being with them?
Well, it's different depending on the organization. Like the nurses, they will donate to your campaign and they also have the network. The other organizations, they will put out fundraising emails for you, but there has to be a different delineation between your campaign and theirs. Mm-hmm. So really, the benefit of being part of these organizations and being endorsed is the outreach and networks of their members. And it also is kind of, it's a way for people who maybe don't have the time to look up all of the legislation of each and every candidate, they can know automatically, well, if this candidate is endorsed by Our Revolution or Brand New Congress or Justice Democrats, I know the platform that they're running on. I know they're not accepting money from corporations. I know they're for Medicare for All.
There's a scene in the movie where you're trying to raise money. It seems really hard to do, raising money. And frankly, uncomfortable.
Hi, Edmund. This is Amy Villela. Was just actually doing my fundraising calls and saw your name. Didn't know if you'd be able to help us out one last time.
I'm not sure if I can.
Okay. Did I catch you at a bad time? You know, even $50 would be absolutely amazing.
Really not in a position to go much further, I'm afraid. I hate to take your time.
It is very difficult. It was a lot of hours. I mean, as a candidate, you probably spend 6 hours a day fundraising. And, you know, when you're running in a district where you're running against, you know, five other opponents, and one of them is the chosen one by the DCCC, it's very difficult. And it can be disheartening. You know, throughout the film, you can see me trying to transition even in my appearance. Mm-hmm. The stress and the weight was weighing on me tremendously. And I came, you know, I was not, it was not a bad amount that I fundraised. I fundraised almost $200,000 for a first-time candidate without a Rolodex.
Pretty good.
And without corporate money. What really made the difference in the end is that a union jumped in for my opponent, who was a lobbyist, and put in $500,000 right before the election. So I understood what odds were being put against me. You know, when you have an ex-president, an ex-vice president, a current presidential candidate, unions and the Harry Reid machine coming against you in your district, because, and even Joe Crowley, they
Joe
were
Crowley
very concerned.
From New York, who was running against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
Yes, he was donating to my opponent as well.
Why did he care about your race in Nevada?
My numbers were good. They were coming in and helping out in races where they felt where they were the most at threat.
And little did he know. He probably should have focused
exactly.
A little closer to home.
Exactly.
Okay, well, so given what you just said, you know, the other women who are in the film are running for office again, but you're not. Why aren't you running again? Why aren't you trying again?
You know, I think a common theme throughout the film was that this was never about any of us individually. This was about the movement. And I definitely will run again in the future. That's not a question at all. I will run. But at this point, I think my energy is better suited to help my choice in the presidential election.
And
help.
Who is that?
It's Bernie Sanders.
Mm. Well, Amy Villela, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Villela, she ran for the House from Nevada's 4th Congressional District in the midterms last year. She is now in the documentary, Knock Down the House, which you can see on Netflix. And you can hear in 15 minutes our new show, Greater LA, hosted by Steve Chiatakis, who's in the studio now with a preview. Hi.
Hello, Madeline Brand. Obviously, the workforce is changing. And computers are doing a lot of the work of people, right? And at the port of L.A., they're really sensitive to this because the cargo ships come in, they bring all the stuff that's imported from other countries, and
busiest
people
are... Busiest port in the nation.
Busiest port, certainly on the West Coast, but in the nation, and one of the busiest in the world, and computers and robots are taking the jobs of people, and some workers are worried about that. We're going to talk to some of those workers coming up and get the perspective, the academic perspective, as it were, in the new economy as well. Maybe not such a bad thing if you can retrain people to do other things. Yes.
Okay. Well, that sounds fantastic. Really interesting. Coming up in 15 minutes on Greater LA, right here on KCRW. Guess what? We're not robots yet.
Yet.
Real human beings who put out a radio show every single day, who staff the music department, bring you the best in music.
I see
arts,
where you're going
culture,
with this, yeah.
The news, real people, but real people cost money. I mean, we do have to live.
Yes.
Right? And we have to keep the lights on here, and that's where you come in. We are in our last week of the UnDrive. Pledge drive.
Your ears obviously get a lot of worth out of this radio station
each
and every day. And if you use it, if you value it, step up now. Last week of the drive, this is a big deal.
KCRW.com/join. And, you know, only partially joking about the robots, because a lot of stations do have automated playlists and are really run by computers. KCRW is not.
No.
So that's because of you. KCRW.com/joinshirt. It's cheaper to use machines, but who wants that?
Who wants that? That's right. No fun.
No fun at all. Right. KCRW.com/join. Hey, coming up, speaking of fun, the album that saved your life. KCRW's Ann Litt will be here to share her pick. If you have one, we'd like to hear that, actually. Go on Twitter, tweet us at KCRW Press Play, the album that saved your life. And that conversation is coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life from a broken heart. Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life with a song.
Okay, maybe you can relate, a song saving your life or a DJ saving your life, metaphorically, of course. Maybe you have an album that saved your life. Well, tonight, KCRW and our Lost Notes podcast is presenting a live show. It's a conversation, really. It's called This Album Saved My Life. DJ Ann Litt is hosting the event, and she's here now.
Hi, Madeline.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first of all, I want to know, have you saved anyone's life as a DJ?
You know what? Oh, my. I wouldn't presume to think I have, but I certainly know my life has figuratively been saved by DJs and music throughout the years. And I hope I've had some sort of a small impact on somebody. And I hear stories. I love hearing from listeners stories about a song played at a perfect moment that's really made a difference.
So that's what you're talking about, is not literally, obviously, saving a life. I mean, an album is not going to stop a bullet, for example.
Right.
A physical album. But when you're in a moment of crisis or a moment, a fork in the road, sometimes music can either, you know, make you feel better. It can make you feel like you're understood. It can maybe provide the answer that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And I also think the interesting thing about this conversation is that it's a universal one. I think every single person, all of you listening, have some kind of piece of music that has, you know, saved your life or that has framed a very pivotal moment in your life. And so it's a conversation I love to have with people because everybody can answer immediately. If you say, what is your favorite album right now? I'll give you 25 answers. But if you say, what was an album that changed you in a moment? I think everybody can answer that question quickly.
Okay. So what have you brought?
Well, the first piece of music I brought is something I used to hear in my house when I was a kid. And I can vividly remember my parents' record collection and looking at all the different albums they had and just poring over the artwork and the liner notes. And I knew when my parents turned on the stereo, it was going to be a fun night. You know, it was one of those things where my dad got out the hi-fi. You know, we knew it was they were having a good time. And they used to always play Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. So I brought in A Taste of Honey from Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's definitely a party, Anne. I could see your parents. I could see them with maybe a martini.
Oh, yeah.
Your mom kind of like grooving.
Oh, yeah. And I can also see all of the other albums in their collection. Dave Brubeck, Take Five, and Harry Belafonte.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a very specific collection of music, but that was my first music that informed the way I thought. And to this day, I will put that on at a party because I think it's the ultimate in party music. So is it a throwback for me? Is it a reason I'm doing what I'm doing today? I don't know. But that is Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass will always set me straight.
Okay, great. What else?
Well, the second thing I brought in was when I was in the fourth grade, I discovered the Beatles. Now, this was long after the Beatles had had their heyday. And I always say I discovered all kinds of music out of order from when it actually was released. But a girlfriend of mine's aunt had sent her Sgt. Pepper's. And we used to go over to her house after school and, you know, pore through the liner notes and sing the songs and the whole thing. Well, for my birthday, my 10th birthday, I begged my parents for a cassette of the Beatles. And they came home with Revolver, which is sort of a strange choice if you know the Beatles and you know that album. It's sort of an odd choice. And this song, I want to play the song. I want to play the song and then I'll tell you about it. But it's For No One by the Beatles. And this song really messed me up.
Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing.
Wow.
No sign of love behind the tears.
Okay, so your parents, what were they thinking?
I don't know, but here's what I can tell you about that album. And I remember when I listened to it for the first time, that cassette, and that song came on. I know exactly where I was. We were on the entry road to Disney World in Florida. I kid you not. And I had a tape recorder, you know, one of those ones that you would push, play, and record at the same time. And I had one of those little earbuds that I took from my dad's transistor radio. And I was listening for no one in the backseat. I was crying. I didn't understand the song. But I knew that it was important, and it was about a very adult emotion and an adult situation that was very sad and very important. And I didn't remotely begin to comprehend what the song was about, but that song always stuck with me. And then I didn't listen to it for years. And then years later, I actually listened to it as, you know, more of an adult, and devastated me completely.
You know, I had the same experience with Don McLean's song American Pie.
Yeah.
I had no idea what the lyrics meant.
Oh, the day the music died.
Yeah.
The music died. So bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.
I knew it was super sad, but I had no idea, and I probably still don't have any idea what it's about.
Right. Well, it's about Buddy Holly.
Okay.
The day the music died. But I heard that song too.
When he was killed.
Yes.
In a plane crash.
Exactly. And I didn't know what it meant either. To me, it was a sing-along. And I think that the effect music can have is, as a sing-along, it can be super sad. And if you don't understand what it means, you can interpret it the way you want to interpret it. And what
but
it
you
means
still
to you
know
at the time.
Something's...
Yeah.
It's not a happy song.
Yeah. No, and I and again, that's why I love the concept of an album that saved your life, or an album that changed your life, or a piece of music that changed your life, because the Beatles and that song For No One, if I just want to make myself cry, I just put that song on, because now as an adult, it means something so different. But as a little girl, it was really a big moment for me because it was that sort of, I'm about to pass into a different point in my life, and I know it's big, but I don't know what's coming. But Madeline, you know, I also put it out on Twitter because we're doing this event tonight, this Lost Notes event, which I'm excited about. And you can actually go to kcrw.com/events and RSVP for it now and bring a story or bring your album that changed
you.
Yes, we'll be discussing that, and we'll be asking the audience as well.
Fantastic. So did you already get some responses?
Well,
online?
I did. I went on Twitter and I just put it out there and said, hey, we're doing this event. What album saved your life or changed your life? And I've compiled a list here, and I'll tell you who's getting the most votes right now are the Smiths, either the self-titled album or The Queen Is Dead.
So I broke into the palace with a sponge and a rusty spanner. She said, I know you and you cannot sing. I said, that's nothing you should hear me play piano. We can go for a walk where it's quiet and dry and talk about precious things. But when you're tied to your mother's apron, no one talks about castration.
There are also a lot of great choices on here as well. The Nationals' Trouble Will Find Me, 10 Sumner's Tales by Sting, James Taylor, Mudslide Slim.
I mean, do you find that most of these songs or most of these albums are pretty melancholic? Because I think when you think of saving your life, you're in a point in your life where you're not, you know, feeling groovy necessarily.
Right.
You're feeling
true.
A little low. And so maybe you are looking for music that is speaking to that feeling at that moment.
Absolutely.
I mean, I remember listening to Carole King.
Oh, Tapestry is on here too.
Yeah, that's one that I would say would be one of those albums for me because I was a little girl then, and that was during Watergate and during upheaval in my own family. And then this came along, and it's a lot of it is in a minor key.
My life has been a tapestry of rich and royal hue, an everlasting vision of the ever-changing view.
For sure.
It's still, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of those songs are sad.
They are.
You've got a friend so far away. I mean,
We're just bringing everybody down here, Madeline.
I know.
And I know a lot of people have really happy albums and happy songs that have changed their life as well. Maybe the song somebody danced to at their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to lots of people. I'm always fascinated by what songs people choose to dance to at their wedding. And that's usually a song that's touched them in a more positive way. So, I mean, we could have this conversation all afternoon long. I will say most of the ones I have gotten have been, as you pointed out, on the more melancholic side.
Okay, well, let's go out on a happy one. Do you have a song that maybe... I don't know. We can all rally around right now.
Well, I'll tell you what. I played this on the air this past weekend, and I think Lizzo is a phenomenal human being.
Yes.
She puts on an excellent live show. When she tours, her entire crew is female. Everybody who works for her is female. She walks the walk when it comes to representing for women. And a song off her new album just kills me, and I dance to it like crazy. It's Juice by Lizzo.
Amleth, that was so much fun, or at least it was at the end.
For sure.
Thank you so much. And if you want more Amleth and more of this particular topic, you can see her tonight here at KCRW headquarters in Santa Monica for the event that she's hosting called This Album Saved My Life. It's tonight at 7, and you can RSVP at kcrw.com/events.
Holla, baby, please don't make me have to take your sorrow if I'm shining.
Okay, we want your juice in the form of your contribution to kcrw.com/join. Hey, throw us a few bucks our way. We are in the middle. No, we're not in the middle. We're at the end of our UnDrive fundraiser. And so this is our, you know, we come to you twice a year to get you to help support your public radio station, and we cannot do it without you. So what we're doing is we're just taking a few minutes here and there. We're not interrupting programming, so you can listen to all the Lizzo that you want. But we do need you to do your part. KCRW.com/join. We have tons and tons of incentives for you there on the website, including all sorts of fabulous sweepstakes, Hollywood Bowl tickets, all kinds of great juice. So KCRW.com/join. Do it now. The end, the last week of our UnDrive fundraiser. So do it now. And thank you. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.